Yo, everyone, welcome back to Brand New Techish. We in the building. It's Michael Behane with the amazing
Abadesi.
Abadesi. All right, let's get it cracking. I want to start with a story which I'm really, really excited to hear your opinion on, actually, because...
Don't do this to me, Michael. People have been saying they're loving the honesty and the tea I'm bringing. Now you're going to compromise my ability to be objective.
Well, let's keep it real. So, okay, if you're a long-time listener of Techish, you'll know that Abadesi is a member and loves a co-working space called The Wing, which is centered around women.
Proud member of The Wing.
Proud member of The Wing. And the CEO, Audrey Gelman, recently stepped down from the position of CEO. She's the founder. And it's got all to do with a perceived lack of intersectionality within the company. So essentially, people of color, black and brown people, the working staff, the cleaners, the maintenance staff, being treated poorly, not being paid right. Mm-hmm. Some issues of racial tension with members versus employees. Then there was a situation where they donated a certain amount of money to Black Lives Matter to show their solidarity, but then it turned out they still hadn't paid a lot of their furloughed staff. So a lot of the staff members were still waiting for their money, essentially, for this whole COVID, 19 situation. And I read a quote from an Instagram comment. Hold up, how do you have 200K for orgs when you still haven't paid numerous employees that applied for the Employee Relief Fund?
Oof.
Okay, so I'm sorry for that long preface, Abba. I've set you up there, but last time we spoke about this, both of us felt like that there might be undue criticism of women founders or too much of a spotlight.
Yes.
What do you make of it all, really? Like, what's going on here? Like, I don't even know how to unpack all this myself. Like, what
I
do
mean,
you think?
I was really shocked when I heard that Audrey Gelman was stepping down. I think a part of me had feared that something like this would happen, because in the circles I'm a part of, there's a lot of anti-Wing sentiment. And I often find myself being their sole defender in WhatsApp groups I'm in with female founders, black female founders, women of color founders, our virtual living rooms. I always have these conversations. And there have been, as far as I can tell, a disproportionate amount more of racial tension between members in the US than here in the UK, right? So I never experienced any of those stories I heard, like white members accusing black members of taking parking spacing, not realizing that they're a member of the Wing themselves. So I will say, I personally never experienced or witnessed any of that. Now, I did, of course, notice that a lot of the hourly staff, from cleaners to kitchen workers, were disproportionately people of color. And when COVID hit, a number of us members were very concerned about their welfare, their financial security, if they're not salaried workers, if they're not furloughed. And these are certain issues which never seemed to be properly resolved, or at least communicated clearly how they're going to be helped. But here's the thing, right? Before The Wing came along, no one had called out, I mean, at least at this magnitude and this level, the fact that we as women do need a space of our own where we feel safe to have conversations about the unique challenges they face. And, I was very proud to make my investment in The Wing, because it was just so cool to show up somewhere and bump into people like Liv Little and Charlie Brinker's Cuff of Galdem just sitting on a table with you, and be able to just chat with them. You know what I mean? And like Tracy at Block Party. And, I went to an event with Cindy Gallup. I just feel like the value they delivered to members was incredible, like over and beyond any members club or co-working space I've been to. Like, I have to give them that. Now, were they free of, the short-sighted policies and strategies that many of us in this oppressive, institutionally racist society make? Of course not, right? I get that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, here's an opportunity, right? We've been talking about Alexis Ohanian stepping down from the board at Reddit. And I just wonder, is Audrey Gelman stepping down saying that actually, if we really want to be an intersectional feminist organization, we need a woman of color making decisions here, because my white privilege has obviously blinded me to what the real priorities are? And like, let's face it, I have had a lot of conversations behind closed doors with black women in tech over these past few weeks, being very observant of which communities that supposedly stand for all women have been pretty damn silent about BLM, or they had one newsletter edition about it, one post about it, and that's it. Now they're coming out the woodworks asking black women in tech to come in and guest post and come in and do this. And it's like, well, you didn't show up for us before. Is this just a tokenization of me now because you need to jump on the bandwagon? So I think there's more reckoning to come within our space for supposedly all female spaces, all women's spaces, which have not been intersectional, which have clearly not been pro-black either. Yeah. The Wing is the first, but More soon come. Honestly, that's my prediction.
I think you're right. I think more soon come. I think America is such a segregated, racially, I don't even want to say racially divided, I would say racist, you know, yeah, racist society, that is it possible to even have social spaces like that without that coming into play? I don't think so. It reminds
Good
me of,
question.
And we're going to talk about Starbucks later. It reminds me of how, like, in Starbucks, those dudes tried to use the bathroom, and the black dudes, when they were accosted and say, well, yes. Like, you can't use the toilets. You know, people use the toilets all the time in Starbucks. They never buy anything. Do you know what I mean? As in, unless you have that kind of proactive action taken to ensure that your company is not racist, just by default, there's going to be racist shit going down. Do you know what I mean?
Right there. Absolutely. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming in that regard, because this is a system set up on racism. And to be honest, I can make the same argument of any white country. Like, I think the same would happen here in the UK. You know, like I said, just because I didn't witness it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And we still had the issues with staff and which staff were on payroll and which staff were not getting benefits. You know, we had that still here in the UK. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a reason why Ethel's Club is so popular. The founder posted that membership had gone up 100% the first week following Black Lives Matter. It's so sad, though, because that's not the future I want. The future I want isn't one where we go, well, we can't stop white people being racist. We can't stop straight people being homophobic. We can't stop non-Muslims being Islamophobic. So let's all just go into our little tribes.
And
you know, you do your thing, we'll do ours. I don't want that. And so for me, like, to your point, it's like, if we don't actively move away from that default, if we don't actively optimize for equality, then the spaces will always be inherently flawed. So it's almost like we as entrepreneurs, as participants in tech, have to consider, like, where in the design process or even ideation process, we start to fall into the trap of perpetuating the system.
Absolutely. And I think the word default is the key thing. If by default you don't do anything proactive to kind of combat those kind of inequalities, by default, your platform, your space, your company will have those biases. We talked last week about how, you mentioned it briefly, how Reddit's Alexis Ohanian, co-founder of Reddit, is stepping down and recommended that his board seat be given to a black person to fill his board seat. And up stepped up Michael Seibel, who is the CEO of YC. And he's been appointed. Now, I want to say something real quick. Michael Seibel, I've spoke to him briefly on a call for like 2 seconds. And to me, he always seemed like super helpful. This is when I started Pocket. We had no traction, nothing. And he was willing to kind of get on a call and do a quick chat, whatever. Super friendly, super helpful. I think he's the real deal. But what I
agree. And I also emailed him in the early days of Hustle Crew. I mean, literally had just launched the MVP. And he does reply to every email. Respect.
Yeah, respect to him. I think he's a genuine person, and he does seem like a very credible person in terms of like his experience in the tech sector. But I did see some pushback where it was like, why does it always seem like it's the same 4 black people who get the opportunity? We've got to have that real talk.
Ain't nobody asked me.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Speak on that, because so we get the preface. Listen, Michael Seibel, good pick, like super credible, super smart dude, right? But he's already established. He's already, you know, super prominent within the tech space. Was this an opportunity to give it to somebody who is coming up, who might have a different vantage point, who might know what it's like, you know, to raise money in the last 2 years, or who might know what it's like to bootstrap in the last 2 years? Or do you know what I'm saying? Like, was
there space
for that?
So I had the same conversation with Sydney Fussell. He's a senior reporter at Wired. Yeah. And Xavier Hardin, who does content at Mozilla. Actually, to be honest, even Megan Rosicki of TechCrunch, because we were all involved in this panel last week, and there is a recording available on my Twitter if folks want to check it out. But in the conversation we had leading up to this panel, we brought this up and we looked at that tweet and we were just like, what is it about gatekeepers in tech? Because this is what it comes down to, isn't it? Like, ultimately, the remaining people on the board had to make a call about who would replace Alexis, not us as the black community. No one asked us. No one canvassed around the black community. No one got all the black Redditors into a Zoom call and were like, hey, everybody, who do you think is best, right? The existing board members, the existing gatekeepers made this decision. And exactly as you said, Michael, they pick a guy who, don't get me wrong, is an incredible leader in our space. He's done so much, but he already has a lot on his plate. And I feel like Michael Seibel's views of the world have been very clearly shared in all the work that he's done. Like, we know what he's about. YC Startup School is real. You know, all the programs, winter and summer, are real. Like, he does his stuff. He knows where he's at, obviously, with Twitch and everything that he built before. Like, I just kind of feel that there was an opportunity to diversify the Black voices involved in this space at this level, and the opportunity was missed. And it's so frustrating. And a part of me, the cynical part of me, who understands that what is happening right now is also a shift in power, if we as a Black community are successful in achieving the goals we want to achieve, a part of me makes me think that a decision was made to pick a quotation marks safe Black person.
Right.
Because I feel that like the pace of change that we often talk about could be interpreted as scary for some people, right? Because we know what we want and we want it now. We're like, all right, let's blacken it up in here. But not only us, right? We're like shouting out to all the underrepresented and marginalized groups.
Yeah.
I feel like someone with a bit more impatience and a clearer vision for how to increase representation could come in and really shake things up and really challenge the board to face topics which could make them feel uncomfortable. Like someone could come on the board and be like, right, y'all have white privilege. Let's discuss what that means and how that limits our decision-making as a company. But they probably don't want to engage in that conversation. Yeah. And so they pick someone who isn't going to make them engage in that conversation.
I agree with you because I think it, I mean, okay, this is real. YC still struggles with representation, even itself. And he's the CEO, right? So if you're picking somebody who's this, listen, and I'm not saying this against Michael Cyber, I'm sure he's making efforts to make it work. But for all I can see right now, there hasn't been, you know, dramatic change. There might have been some change, but not dramatic, right? So if you're bringing him on board, you know, is that necessarily going to do anything for like, well, I guess he does bring a Black voice and a Black perspective, but he might not necessarily like, you know, push them to say, okay, we need this many employees who are Black and we need, you know, this many white supremacist threads shut down ASAP, right? He might not give them that push. I don't know, Michael.
I think you're right though, because like, let's look at Y Combinator's track record. I've been to their offices in San Francisco. I mean, they look diverse-ish, but I don't have the stats. We can look at the track records of previous batches for Summer Accelerator Program, Winter Accelerator Program. Look, this is well-documented. You can just go on Medium and type in, is Y Combinator racist? Y Combinator Black founders? We won't be the first people to say it. People have done the analysis and looked at the receipts and seen that Y Combinator is disproportionately white, disproportionately male. In recent years, they've tried to increase representation of Black and brown founders, people from international cohorts, but it's still a drop in the ocean relative to like the precedents and the history. So to your point, yes, if we want to know how he's going to mix things up at Reddit, we only have to look where he is the leader right now.
Yeah, I think, and to be fair to YC, they're not any different than the rest of Silicon Valley in that what we've said in terms of all of those stats. It's just I'm saying that they're obviously not an outlier in any good sense. So you haven't brought somebody in who's going to bring radical change per se, right? And that's the frank reality.
And the thing about that is like, it really upsets me that we still have to consider achieving equality as radical. You know what I mean? Like the shackles, right? The proverbial shackles of white supremacy are so strong that the idea of introducing equality, introducing representation, giving attention to the voices of Black and other marginalized communities on this social platform and this impacting community feels so far removed from anything else we do. We still have to call it radical. How is it radical?
When I say radical, I mean in terms of like the velocity of change, not necessarily what that change is. So radical change in this context, I would mean like how quickly are they making it happen overnight, right? As opposed to, is it radical to have, you know, Black people at your company? Of course not.
Also, while we're speaking on it, just before we wrap up, Alexis said in his video that stepping down can be a sign of power, because if you acknowledge that you have privilege, you acknowledge that you get an easier ride in tech than Black entrepreneurs and Black business leaders, there's an opportunity for you to acknowledge that it was easier for you to access that board seat than someone else from our community. So by stepping down, you can transfer that power to a decision maker from an underrepresented group and give them the agency that they need to drive change and create the world that they want to see. No one else has done it since.
Yeah, I guarantee you nobody will, because I think he has a very unique vantage point in the sense that he does have a Black wife, he does have a Black daughter, and obviously whatever his, you know, personality is, he's obviously, you know, seems
Ben
to actually genuinely
care. Ben Horowitz has a Black wife.
I mean, a lot of people do, but not everybody also genuinely cares about the struggle also. Mm. You see what I'm saying? In tandem. It's those two things I think just made him think, you know what, I've got to step out of the way.
Yeah.
And then it also helps to be super rich as well. It also helps that you've already got a boatload of things to do. He's already... you know, he's running Initialized Capital and they're doing some good work. I've seen them made some good investments in Black founders, for example. But it's not as in he was drowning in opportunity. So am I going to expect a boatload of people to all of a sudden step down and do the same thing? No, I'm not holding my breath, to be honest. But we'll see.
We'll see. We'll see. Hey, everybody. This episode is sponsored by a good friend of Tekish and one of my all-time favorite people in the universe. Huge inspiration to me. Very accomplished tech leader, Arlen Hamilton, and her brand new book, It's About Damn Time, How to Turn Being Underestimated into Your Greatest Advantage. Now, if you're like me and you've ever felt underestimated for any reason, this is definitely the book for you. I highlighted so many sections. Honestly, I wish I read it sooner. In the book, Arlen drops so many gems on how she went from being homeless on food stamps to being a pioneering venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, setting up the legendary Backstage Capital, which has gone on to invest over $7 million in more than 130 companies, all led by underrepresented founders. So, if you want to know how a Black gay woman broke into the boys' club of Silicon Valley with no network, no contacts, not even a college degree, go get your coffee. This book is for you. I think for all of us, we need that handbook of resilience. We need that playbook for advancing our careers. And this is absolutely that Bible for success that should be taking a prime spot on your bookshelf. I know I, for one, will never take it out of my backpack. That's how real it is.
Yeah, listen, 100%. I think I read this whole book in like one day's flat and I underlined the whole damn thing. And definitely, like, my favorite part is how she managed to hustle her way backstage to She managed to hustle her way backstage at a conference to speak to like a leading VC when everybody was trying to scramble for the dude's attention. And she managed to do it because it typifies the kind of mindset you need. You've got to outsmart the competition, especially when you're starting off like us, when you're coming from behind. And then even like when she talks about the power of information, like turning yourself into a, to an asset, essentially, to the point where she leveled up and then she became an industry expert, all off just reading newsletters, podcasts, books. And definitely this book has got to be part of your journey to help you level up. So yeah, It's About Damn Time. The link will be in the show notes. If you do get the book, use the hashtag Tekish. Take a picture of it, send it to us. We love like knowing that you take our opinion seriously. So like, yeah, It's About Damn Time. Link in the show notes. So yeah, this is a quick funny story. Yeah, I was scrolling through my timeline and I see an argument on Instagram Live between Terrence J, the former BET and 106 and Park host, and Marlon Wayans from the Wayans family.
Oh, I love the Wayans.
Yeah. Ryan, play the clip now.
This ain't all about your family, okay? Your family can't bail you out of this one, all right?
No, but let me tell you something about family. No, I'm gonna tell you something. I'm gonna tell you something about family. People, I don't never need them to bail me out of nothing.
Bro,
I'm gonna tell
you
something.
Bro,
they raised me. They raised you. If you ever think I'm great because of me, I'm not. I'm great because
I'm great because of the tribe.
Yeah. So I was watching this and cracking up, thinking to myself, "What the hell is going on here? Like, why is Terrence hating on the fact that Marlon is like, you know, successful partly because of his family? Like, you know how we always say how." Generational wealth, we got to bring our people in. But as soon as somebody practices that kind of thing, all of a sudden now we're like, well, I did it on my own. And it's like, well, do we want to, like, do you not want to help your son or your brothers or your cousins? So why are you mad at somebody else for helping their brother, son, cousin, right?
Yeah.
But then it turned out the whole thing was a parody because literally, I went through my timeline. I typed in Terrence J on Twitter, and everybody's like, "Terrence J, he's an idiot. I never liked him. He was about to get punked real quick." And then Terrence and Marlon came out and was like, "Yo, sorry, the whole thing was a prank. The whole thing was a parody." And it went from a story about, like, you know, nepotism and generational wealth in my mind to a story about how cancel culture is just ready. We are ready to cancel you and make one mistake against somebody that we like. Because people are about to have Terrence out of here. So be careful who you argue with. That's what I'm saying.
Let's do a social experiment. Let's me and you fall out.
I'm not doing
over
that.
Twitter and see who gets the most support. I mean,
are you mad? I will get canceled so quickly. But you are beloved. I will be out of here. I ain't doing that. You're crazy.
I don't know. I told you people be sending me videos of you as babies and whatnot. Like, no, man, you got fans. You got fans. You got stats.
I got a small cop following. I want to give a quick shout out to Get Squire. They are a Black-owned startup. Essentially, they're an app that allows you to discover barbers, book appointments, and pay for haircuts directly on your mobile device. And they've raised $34 million on a Series B. So shout out to Sonj and Dave Savant. I've interviewed Dave for Pocket way back when.
Yes.
And he seemed like a pretty smart, savvy guy. I mean, $34 million, Series B. Like, You know how we always talk about what is the percentage of, you know, black founders that have raised a certain amount of money? What is the percentage of black founders that have raised a Series B? I would struggle to even, like, you're talking about a handful of people here, right?
Yeah. I mean, nothing's coming to my mind right now. So this is pretty epic.
Yes. Like, as in, what's that other company? Play VS? What's the other one?
Play Versus.
Play Versus. Yeah, how much did they raise? Like 100 plus, 100 million, right? Something like that.
Yes, they have. I don't even know if they've got to Series B stage yet, though. They just were kind of like doing follow-on rounds, seed and then Series A.
Oh, yeah. I want to clap that up. Ryan, put in the applause. Shout out to them. And it's funny because I think so many people approached me like 2-3 years ago saying, oh, I want to do like an app for barbers. And it's going to be like, because obviously, like, as black men, we spend a lot of times in our barber shops and we realize that the software is non-existent. You might be paying cash in hand. There's no booking schedule. Your barber's really operating like it's 1975, right? So a lot of black people saw that and was like, oh, how do we build a startup around this? But these dudes actually did it. And they scaled it up. And there's a big difference between having the idea and following through and executing, because I think every single person who approached me with the idea didn't do anything. So shout out to them. I'm keeping it real. Shout out to them.
So cool. Great.
Just quickly also to add to this whole situation with GetSquire raising a whole bunch. On People of Color in Tech, we partnered with a few other great entrepreneurs and we came up with the Black Founder List. And it's a list, database essentially, of all black founders who have raised VC funding and how much they've raised, and we're going to add who they've raised it from. So if you want to know, we've got around 300-400 people in the database. You can add yourself to the database and be approved. It's not for bootstrap founders just yet, it's just for VC, because we want to really highlight the, you know, the situation in terms of black founders raising money. So go check it out. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's called the Black Founder List. Yo everyone, just a quick reminder, use the hashtag techish and let us know what you think of the episode. We want to hear from you. If you think I'm talking rubbish, if you think Abadesi is, you know, a genius, which is the normal play of things, I ain't jealous.
Lies.
I want to know. Hashtag techish. Open your Twitter app right now and do it, please.
So in the roller coaster of corporate brands' responses to supporting Black Lives Matter, but, you know, not quite knowing where to start or how to execute it because they don't have enough black people making decisions, joining the ever-growing list of brands to not quite get it right is Starbucks. Did you hear about this, Mike? Mm. So basically,
I did.
A lot of folks, of course, in solidarity with the movement, have been wearing black clothing, Black Lives Matter related clothing. And Starbucks originally decided that they were going to ban staff members wearing black, wearing anything that, quotation marks, advocated a political, religious, or personal issue. How bizarre. Lo and behold, right. of course they faced a backlash and then reversed a decision. Michael, can you tell me, with all of the examples from next door and the Twitter storm that broke out when their black employee was like, are you kidding me with BLM right now? How are we still having such colossal mess ups? And I'm pretty sure Starbucks has a global diversity and inclusion lead and a big ass D&I team paying loads and loads of money to those folks. How does this happen?
Yeah, I mean, do you remember I mentioned earlier the whole, when the dudes wanted to use the bathroom and then, you know, they weren't allowed to, and that whole racist hoopla, and then they had to shut down the stores for racist diversity training. Whoever gave them that training didn't do it right. They could have hollered at you, Abba, that's what I'm saying. Because you know what? I don't know what they were thinking. But it's hilarious watching companies just scramble. Honestly, I find it so entertaining to watch companies, and I can just tell in the boardrooms, it's like, oh my God, what do we do? What do we do? How do we fix this? Like, because they so quickly reversed the decision, and then they think they threw up an Instagram post that was like, we see you, we hear you,
oh,
we understand. I was like, oh my Lord, here we go. Like, all because they wouldn't let people wear Black Lives Matter pins. I don't know.
Do you think that the social media teams, I mean, the people posting, at least somewhere along that chain of events, surely there is a black person going, is this really what we want to do right now? Is this really what we want to say?
I don't know.
Or is representation that low?
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's such a large company and it might be a bit decentralized that maybe somebody just, you know, made a decision. It's like, yeah, you can't wear that. You're not allowed to wear that. Of course you can't. Like maybe head of HR or something. I don't know. And then all of a sudden it trickles up to like the senior executives when they realize the branding, you know, and the company PR backlash they were going to get, and they reversed it. I don't know. I don't think it's one and the same person who's sitting there changing their mind. I think often these decisions are made in a decentralized manner. The backlash happens, then it bubbles up to the people who actually know what they're doing or know what the wider repercussions are. Then it gets reversed, right? Now, the person who made that initial decision, do they get fired? Do they get in trouble? Do they get reprimanded? I don't know. I wouldn't sit there and think it's one person, you know, twirling their mustache, you know, and then making the decision, then they're reversing it. That's the thing.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, of course.
While we're on this topic, so you've spent almost half a decade now working directly with brands that want to...
Oh, you're old. Lord have mercy, don't do that to me.
You're younger.
It's 5 years,
it's
not half a decade.
Good.
Don't say half a decade, it's 5 years. Go on.
Okay, so you spent 5 years building a community as well as a jobs board, connecting with corporate brands that want to improve the perception of their employer brand across Black and brown communities, show their support for Black and brown communities, and ultimately increase diversity and inclusion within their company culture. So I know that like one of the things that you have developed as part of your like set of products is this like corporate branding page, and like basically like the importance of brands being able to talk about what they care about through the lens of your expertise, right? Through the Black community, like share those selling points. So for time now, you've offered this solution that companies can invest in to show off their commitment to Black and brown community, and also like show off what they give to employees from these backgrounds.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that you have a lot of inventory there. It's not like every company in the world has invested in one of those pages and is like doing that work.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say is like, how does it make you feel when you've spent, you know, half a decade or 5 years talking to corporations about the importance of doing this work and about the importance of, you know, being involved in the community, telling the community about opportunities, building that bridge to increase representation. You've said the value of that. Now something like this happens, right? Where people have not done the work and it is blowing up in their face and they're getting publicly humiliated, shamed by their customers. How does it make you feel to kind of be like, look at those brands and be like, oh, well, I told you so, but you haven't done the work. I'm just wondering what kind of emotions are going through your head right now, because this is work that you've said is valuable. And now it's like, people are like, oh, this is work that is valuable. It's like the realization has finally sunk in. How does it feel?
I do want to talk about the fact that not even just myself, everybody I know who's, you know, is running a Black-owned company, particularly who's running a Black-owned company that's working on representation. For example, I have a friend of mine who's running, you know, a blog on being a Black foodie. I know you, I know me, right? Everybody now has seen an uptick in interest, right? Full stop. Everyone like, oh yeah, companies reaching out, deals that weren't going to happen before now may possibly happen. So it's like, you can taste the desperation because the people are just like, we never gave it ish before, but now we can get in trouble for this. Now we give it ish, right? And it's like, what do you do in that scenario? Like, do you take people on board and say, listen, all right, cool, but this is why, you know, this was always relevant and why you didn't see it before? Or do you just take the money and be like, all right, cool, you want, I'll trust that you want to make amends or you want to do better now? I don't know. It's difficult. I don't have a, you know, it's a very thoughtful question. I don't necessarily have an answer. A lot of these companies, like I said, are completely decentralized. And that is the problem. Like, a lot of individuals within these companies want to do good work. You might be the head of D&I. You might be the head of HR and genuinely want to make a change. But then you have people like, you know, you've gone and done talks where there's individuals within the company in a whole different department are just like, oh, I don't see race. I don't see color. Like, what is all this like? This is irrelevant to me, right? So I've realized these companies are very complicated entities and organisms, and like, not everyone has the same incentive or the same desires within these companies.
It's so interesting because I feel that people like us in the diversity space, in the representation space, we have to bring our identity, our sense of self, and our sense of where we sit in society into the work we do, even though a lot of people, you know, if we hadn't chosen this life of work, it would be a lot easier to like create some kind of space and boundaries between that. But ultimately, you know, one of the reasons we're fighting for this is because we feel the way things are on a moral and ethical level are also inherently wrong. Like, it's unjust and it's unfair. And I think I am probably one of the worst people for kind of like separating that from my work. Like, you know, that comes into my work a lot. Like, the vulnerability comes into my work a lot. I always think about, you know, why is it so hard? I'm just another person. And I think also in the context of my social group, because my husband is a white man, a lot of our friends are white people, I can directly compare my experience of life and career with their own and see the disproportionate pain, trauma, and hurt I have experienced. So, you know, there's this constant reminder that it is a two-track system. It is an unlevel playing field.
Right.
And as a consequence of that, and you know, this obsession with fairness that I seem to have, which is not healthy, but it was really difficult at the beginning. It was really, really, really difficult. Like, seeing my inbox exploding, seeing my DMs blowing up. And I think, again, just in terms of contrasts, just a few weeks prior to this, I was with my team looking at our numbers, looking at our targets. And, you know, we came to this decision that we should do an outreach campaign. We were just like, wow, it's so dead right now. Like, we got to be thinking of runway. We started like putting together who are the last people we sold workshops to. And I was emailing, calling. I was getting out of office replies. People are on, you know, furlough. People are being made redundant. And I was genuinely strategizing, like, what else can we sell? Because I need to pay my team. These are the conversations we were having at the dinner table with my husband. And then Black Lives Matter happens. And it's like, Abadesi, hustle crew, hustle crew, hustle crew. And I was like, how?
Let's keep it real. It's not Black Lives Matter. The protest, the concept had always existed. What happened is that a black man was murdered and everybody saw it. And it just triggered something in the zeitgeist. So everybody just realized, hold up. And I say everybody, because not everybody. We always done new in it. But I'm saying
people with the purse strings in the companies.
And a lot of white people who probably, because I think they've done tracking on the sentiment on Black Lives Matter, and it was polling at like, you know, maybe 10% approval, and then it went to like 80% approval.
Wow.
If you're looking at like how many people think that there's a systemic racial issue in the country, it went from like some low number to like another super high number overnight because of this one video, right? And it's sad that it takes something so devastating and so cruel.
Yes,
so,
exactly. So my final point on that was that I got on a call with someone and they were just like, oh, Abba, you must be so happy. And I said, I'm not happy. I'm not happy. I was like, I'm not happy that it took, to your point, the lynching of an innocent man to be broadcast across social media for all of you to finally believe me when I tell you that there's value in this work and this is how you change things. Like, that doesn't make me happy. Like, am I hopeful? Am I positive? Yes, but I can't be happy that innocent people had to die for this realization to occur. And then again, bringing that personal into it, I'm sad because he could be my brother. He could be my cousin. He could be my friend. And in many ways he is, because in the Black movement, we are brothers and sisters. While we are united in this struggle, we are all family. And so I can't be happy. It was like, it was sad. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm grateful. Like, we launched membership. Things have gone great, blah, 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 blah. But the spiritual side of me, of course, is in pain of what it took to get us here.
So I want a quick shout out to, again, another shout out to Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter and Square. He's made Juneteenth for company holiday. Nike soon followed. If you don't know, Juneteenth basically celebrates the day that, I mean, roughly, I don't think it's technically the exact day, but it marks the ending of slavery in the US, essentially. So he's made it a company-wide holiday, full paid, full benefits. So shout out to that, because I think so often Black liberation, you know, events, whether that's the Haitian Revolution, whether that's Juneteenth, are often just seen as like, oh, that's a Black thing. Well, actually, to me, I see these as human achievements. For example, I think it was, the amazing Akala who really rammed it home to me, where he's like, listen, the Haitian Revolution is the only example where a slave population overthrew the government and became the government, right? I don't think people are checking it. If we say that we love democracy and liberty and all those, you know, flowery concepts, right? What is greater than that? But it's not really told, because to be honest, the Western powers are the oppressors in the context. So that story, we don't want to have, you know, celebrate the stories of where we're the quote unquote, I say we, quote unquote, we're the bad guys, right? And the same thing with Juneteenth. Like, if you're an American, why do you not want to celebrate the fact that 13% of your population on this day became free? They weren't full citizens, but at least they were no longer in complete bondage, right? So, yeah, it's a no-brainer. I hope other companies follow suit. Shout out to Jack Dorsey for that one.
I think that's a brilliant point. And I just want to qualify that, because at this event on Friday, Megan Rose Dickey of TechCrunch pointed out that she'd been getting lots of press releases from tech companies being like, oh, we're doing Juneteenth too. And she was just like, I want to take it all with a pinch of salt, because I don't want people to jump on this bandwagon and use Juneteenth as a way to get PR if they're still not paying their Black employees properly, if they're still not promoting 100%. them. So, you know, yes, do Juneteenth, but make sure you're doing it alongside other things to create fairer, more equitable practices for your Black employees.
Drop a bomb, Ryan, on that one.
While we plug in stuff, just want to say hustlecrew.co/membership is where you need to be if you want to keep supporting Black employees, even when the hashtag BLM stops trending. From $15 a month, you will access weekly videos and case studies about bias and discrimination and building more inclusive cultures, plus a monthly virtual workshop with yours truly. So head to hustlecrew.co/membership, sign up, get your team on it, try and expense it. See you there.
Go get it.
I need
Yo,
to
Yo, everyone, thank you for listening. That was this week's Techish. Please leave a review. Use the hashtag Techish. Support us on patreon.com/techish if you want to get extra-ish, our new extra podcast for our diehard Patreon supporters. Thanks for listening.
See you there. Also, use hashtag Techish to tell us who should have taken Alexis Ohanian's board seat on Reddit. Maybe it should have been you. I want to hear.
Yep. Catch you next week. Peace.